This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Thank you. Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. I'm William English, and today's this week's guest is Bill Burns. Good afternoon, Bill.
Good afternoon, William.
Bill Burns is director of the Safety Gear for Small Animals. Is this correct?
That's right, and also the Dogs and Boats and Airplanes choir.
The choir. Mm-hmm. Are you a director of that or producer of that?
I'm artistic director of that, yes.
Okay. Yeah. But you've the first track that we just played now, this is a colleague of yours?
Yes, Todd Lippy. He's an old friend of mine in New York, and he's just produced this new album called Here We Are, and it's a lovely album with a beautiful white vinyl that... and it has some lovely tunes, and I just thought it's a nice way to start the show today.
Okay, and that track was called Never.
That's right, yes.
And you were saying something about never travelling to Morden.
That's right. I was thinking of Todd's lyric, and I was on the underground yesterday, travelling from Old Street Station to down to the Oval, and okay. It's a trip I've taken many times in London because I used to go to school in South London.
When you say school, you mean college?
Yes, I was at Goldsmiths College.
University of the Arts now, I suppose, something like that.
I suppose.
Yeah.
But anyways, I was thinking this. This proposition for me a little bit of an existential proposition, that things that you'll never do or things that, and Todd has a kind of a good take on it, I think. And for me, I was thinking, well, I'll never go to Morden, which is the end of this underground line, and it's kind of just a banal thought that I had.
So the whole time you were in London, you never actually went to Morden, is that right?
That's right. I've never been to however, I have been to High Barnet, which is the other end of the line.
But are you saying there's some kind of some metaphor about being at the end of the line or something, or just
No? That wasn't really where I was going with it. My sense is just that there's a kind of a notion that there's finality in our lives, and there's choices we make, and one of them is I probably will never go to Morden station because because life is short.
But Morden is the end of the line. There probably was a station before Morden, and probably still is, that you also wouldn't go to. So
that could be, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we won't stretch this too far. But so Todd Lippy is an artist. Is he Canadian or American? Or?
He's an American artist, as far as I know, and he's been a publisher of a number of fantastic magazines, one of them Public Sphere, which I did a project for in the early 1990s, and another one called Aesopus. And they're both, have beautiful, conceptual art projects in them. And now he runs the Aesopus Foundation in
New York. How do you spell this word? Is Aesopus?
Aesopus. Aesopus.
Aesopus.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And I suppose you can do some anagrams with it and the like.
Right.
And although I've never asked Todd about that. So
I should say you're from Canada. You are Canadian.
Yes, that's right.
But you have a link with Todd in this gallery in New York. What is it?
I guess I met Todd in the early 1990s when I was doing a show at 303 Gallery. And Todd was, he's been doing conceptual projects in print in New York for quite a while. So, the Aesopus magazine was one of my favorite things that arrived in the mail.
Yeah. So this is a hard copy magazine.
Yeah, it is.
It's printed, published like a deluxe thing with prints or something.
Yeah, it has that kind of beautiful printing quality, lots of die cuts and the like inside. So every time you get it, it's kind of a joyful unraveling.
But you were saying that it took a bit of that you started to lose subscribers because of the internet.
It's my suspicion, but right. But it still has a big following even now in its but I think it just became, like a lot of other things in print, difficult to allow it to survive, and it had a great run, so I think
right.
Sometimes those kind of projects are.
But don't you think there's a bit of a swing away from the digital and all that? Maybe not.
I kind of hope so, but yeah. I have had I've had some experience teaching younger people, and really I don't see a big shift.
No.
I see kind of interest in small bits of cottage industry, like doing maybe like chemical darkroom work.
Oh yeah.
But I don't see like a shift from going from Instagram to print media
no.
as much.
Even though you are actually here in London, one of the reasons you're here in London is for a book launch.
That's right.
Of your own. So are you trying to buck the trend, or you're sticking with, or is it an age thing? Or,
well, I don't know really, but I do feel like those things that are have a physical body to me are important. So I'm hoping that the print things survive in the world.
Yeah. So where was your book launch? Was it the Book Art Bookshop on Pitfield Street?
Yeah,
that was actually last Friday. So that's running at the moment, presumably.
Yeah, it's running at the moment, and I have a few, a number of my books are prominently featured in the shop.
Right.
And it's it's a great shop at number 17 Pitfield Street.
In Hoxton.
In Hoxton, yeah.
Yeah. And, so it's a very small bookshop that specializes in artist books, artist publications, and sound works, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're open rather obscure hours, aren't they? Isn't it something odd, like Wednesday to...
Wednesday
it's normal for some galleries to...
kind of gallery hours, Wednesday to Saturday.
Saturday,
from noon to 6.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your books and records are on show there, and some various sort of little... unique artworks, like you do these hand-stitched pennants, I think.
That's right. Yeah, I have some pennants about. So my practice the last seven or 8 years is partly around the ecology of our planet, but partly around the ecology of the construction of our art industry, and so my pennants. Which are felt and hand sewn, make reference to some old girlfriends of mine who have become internationally known curators or museum directors. And some.
Can we name one of them?
Well, the project's called Old Flames, Old Schools, and Old Exhibitions.
Uh-huh.
And so there's one pennant called Kathy. One pennant called Goldsmiths, one pennant called Venice, and they're all and there's one of Documenta, and the like. So,
I think one of them is particularly significant in that hasn't she become director of the National Gallery of Canada or something?
Oh, that's right. Yes, my old friend Kitty Scott is on one of the pennants. Her name.
Okay.
The name.
Has she
Kitty.
Seen the pennant?
I think so, yeah. Yes.
So is that a limited edition or kind of a one-off thing?
It's kind of a limited edition,
okay.
Short run. I'm assuming it will be part of the National
Gallery's
collection.
I suppose a lot of your works are quite enigmatic in that way, aren't they, I think? I mean, you know, you might say, why a pennant for an ex-girlfriend? And and your books, they're quite oblique, I think. I find some of them... Like there's the great milking of a goat ritual,
yeah. So
which I still have trouble trying to comprehend precisely what's going on here, but we don't have to go into that yet. But
I appreciate that.
I mean, I've seen your artworks over the years. You know, the safety gear for small animals is understandable. These are like miniature garments, mm-hmm. Say like a bulletproof jacket for a beaver. Is that one?
Yeah, that's true. Yes,
and sort of which has a poetic, ironic aspect to it, but it's mm-hmm. is fully understandable. Mm-hmm. But I've never managed to get my head around the milking of the goat.
Okay, well, maybe we should go back to the Quranic readings around goat milking and
right
and biblical readings around goats. And you might notice in my projects with goats, I also have.
Okay. We are laughing, but this is for real. I mean, you do actually do this thing.
Yeah. I often have something called someone called a beekeeper comes in, and we render honey in a public place of some sort.
Right.
And there we have, and then I often mix the honey with milk.
I'm just going to interrupt this broadcast. It's Paul Robertson.
Hello, William. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Thank you. It's a sort of bit of an off-the-cuff, impromptu intervention we're having here. I'm at Resonance. This is live on air now. I've got this phone on speakerphone, so I should ask you to refrain from any expletives, Paul.
William, I never swear. You know that.
Okay. So you are director of Lust and the Apple?
Yes, indeed.
A gallery just outside Edinburgh.
Shall I explain it?
Yeah? Is that right?
Okay. Lust and the Apple is 40 miles south of Edinburgh. It's a former primary school. Quite an old-fashioned one, in fact. We still have the original concrete toilets, which are rather amusing. They're corridor of concrete and wooden cubicles and things. But that's one aspect of the place. There's a 1,000-square-meter garden, a car park for 10 cars.
Okay, Paul, I'm going to cut you off there. I've got Bill Burns here, live.
Sorry, I'm boring.
Yeah, Bill. No, it's all right. But Bill Burns is here, and you've been in touch with Bill. Bill.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm good.
You can hear Bill, all right?
Yeah.
Okay, and you have a project. I think Bill Burns was going to pitch something to you about a tea towel.
Really? Yes, I'm very interested in that, actually. Well, Bill, have you been discussing Bill's art all day?
Yeah, we're on the air talking about my art projects a little bit. And,
so you've discussed the safety equipment for small animals, I imagine, and your other environmental projects?
Yeah, a little bit. And I have a tea towel idea that I pitched to you, which is my current project, which is kind of trading commodities around the world, and moving some goat milk and some wood and some salt and olives around the world. And I have this idea of making a tea towel that would explain the project a bit, and William put me up to this call. So
yeah, of course he did. I mean, but yes, I'm very interested.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And
I mean, it's an easy thing to do, mm-hmm. and I think it looked very interesting. I saw the diagram you sent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
So we have a deal, and I think William's probably quite happy now. He seems to like me doing deals on air. He sold me something on air on Resonance before now.
I think you're right.
Paul, what do you make of this goat milking business, Paul?
I don't know fully about the goat milking business. Can I have it more explained to me, please?
Yeah. Well, I was just trying to explain a little bit to William, but it's a little bit hard in some ways, but it's easy in other ways. But I often bring a goat into a public place, like a exhibition space or a public park or something, and I milk the goat. And then I use the milk to make something like a raw cheese. And then I often bring a beekeeper in, and we render some honey. And then I mix milk and honey. And so for me, it's a kind of a natural thing to do, to mix milk and honey and make a reference to kind of political economy and the economy of our art industry. So, but William still isn't buying it.
What do you make? Can you get a handle on this, Paul?
I'm trying to decode it in some ways. I mean, I can see that William's interested both in the environment and more, I suppose, harmonious ways of trading in some respects. I think the interest, I mean, barter has been long out of use in most economies, but in some ways it's a more natural, a more honest approach to dealing. And the art world is probably the furthest away from that system, I can imagine, unless you want me to send you something in return for the details. I like the idea, though. I mean, it's an interesting thing for people to see. But you can't complete the whole process in front of people, can you? I mean, it takes you hours to make the cheese or the butter or whatever you're making.
Yeah, that's true. It's a very long duration. In fact, I'm thinking of the performance as a kind of a 5-year performance. Not the cheese part, but the moving of salt from China to Vancouver, and then the moving of timber from Vancouver to Argentina. So I've been building these transactional relations with people in different places. And if we had a little bit of a Scottish node on the transaction, it would be wonderful.
Well, I'd be interested. I mean, what can you consider here? I mean, what aspect of it could we bring? Or do you buy that? Do you mean the tea towels?
Well, the tea towels could be certainly one thing, and also some kind of performance where we might have some of the...
What's on the tea towels?
Well, the tea towel is a kind of explanation, sort of like the tea towels that you get that explain London, you know, so you have Piccadilly and Buckingham Palace. So the tea towel here will have a goat, a donkey, the donkey being... one of my transport modes for moving salt and apples. I've been having some trades for salt and apples and honey, for instance. So those are kind of things that that I could talk to you about, Paul. Maybe not on the air, but.
Well, no, I owe you an apology because I should really have spoken to you about this before. It's bad luck. I might well have been in London today, but I had an abortive trip last week. I had to come back early. But we can talk. I mean, you've got my number. Take it from him and give me a call after this.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful, Paul. And
All right, Paul. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking part in this broadcast. And we'll speak to you later about the goat milking. Okay.
That's okay. The Comet Show, by the way, is Greg Schneider's films of Joseph Goebbels' house that he has bought and absolutely demolished everything internally to it as a protest against Nazism. So that's the Comet Show here at Lost at the Apple.
Wow.
Great. That's Gregor Schneider, yeah?
Gregor Schneider.
All right,
Paul.
Artist,
one of my favourites.
That's Paul Robertson from the Lust and the Apple Gallery near Edinburgh. Thanks a lot, Paul. Thank you. Okay, back to reality. Bill, over to you. I have to blow my nose now, actually.
Okay, well, I just would reiterate this idea that about the goat milking and the honey rendering, which to me are kind of a way of, you know, sort of gently bringing in my relations with the art industry and sort of calling into some question about what these relations are.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, you've brought in a small, what do we call this gadget you have, this gizmo you've brought in, a sort of portable sound system?
Yeah, it's a soundboard with a motion sensor on it. It's part of a 3-channel sound work that I made. And the content of the music or the recording is the list of the Power 100, which is published by Art Review magazine, British magazine. And
so these are the most powerful people in the art world?
According to this magazine.
Yeah. Yes. And do you dispute this?
I don't either dispute it or it doesn't really. There's things that appeal to me about it and things that don't. But to me, it's just the fact I'm presenting in a certain way.
And you have, in the past, you have sort of made artworks out of confronting specific figures in the art world. Is that true? Well, or addressing them, should we say?
Addressing. I don't think I've ever confronted anyone because I don't really have any... I consider myself implicit in these... in our art industry as much as anyone else is. I don't see, there has to be middling artists as well as
right.
Internationally.
In front of you have a book which was published by Black Dog Press.
Mm-hmm.
What's the title of the book?
My book is called Hans Ulrich Obrist Hieras.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is addressing Hans Ulrich Obrist, one of the biggest movers in the art world. I mean, the title of the book.
The title of the book certainly it does make a call in the kind of sense, but it's a call or a call in the sense, in the similar sense to a call and response prayer kind of thing. So to me, again, it's not a direct. Appeal to Hans Ulrich. It's an appeal, but I mean it is written as an appeal. But it's a traditional biblical kind of appeal, which you can see them in prayer in a number of different Abrahamic prayer systems. You have appeals to different people who have died.
Is the suggestion that Obrist is God?
The Abrahamic prayer system doesn't appeal only to gods.
Oh.
It appeals to people, ancestors, and to even people who are alive. So So it doesn't need to be a god or anything like that. But the only thing I would say is that most of the people I make these projects about, I use the Power 100 list from. Art Review magazine as a kind of a way to as a kind of motif.
So is this So you've let me get this straight. You've made this recording of the Power 100, which lasts for what? How long roughly?
There's about 10 minutes of material in the recording, and I should say that the I commissioned two Georgian singers, two Georgian chanters, Alan Gasser and Emma Whitlaw, and they are fantastic chanters.
Did you say Georgian?
Yeah, Georgian. So it's a form of chant that comes out of Georgia. It has similarities to Gregorian chant, but it has a different polyphonic kind of style.
Right.
And when two people chant in this form, it really does sound like there's 100 people in the room.
Okay. Interesting.
Because of the resonance.
Yeah. So we're going to play a section of this, a two minute section.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. So this will come out over into your microphone. You might have to just move the microphone closer to the speaker or something or whatever. Mm.
And Julia. Wolfgang Tillmans, Marion Goodman, Monica Sprit, and Philomena Majors. Jeff Koons, Bernard Blisten, and Serge Lavigne. Adam Simchik, Okwi, and Weezer, and Peter Steyer. Massimiliano Gioni, and Maya Hoffman. Patricia Phelps, Desis Neros, Beatrix Roof, Mark and Arnie Glimcher, Gavin Brown, Mark Spiegler, Tim Bloom, and Jeff Poe, Gerhard Richter, Eli, and Edith Broad, Pierre Wien, and Theaster Gates.
So that's the end of that section. That's about two and a half minutes.
That's right. And so, I set it up as a three-channel program. And then when people walk into the room, one of them starts and then the second one starts.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of...
I forget what they call that. What is that thing you get in churches where one is overlaying the other until it becomes a sort of
I guess it's a kind of a polyphony.
Polyphonic. Okay. Yeah. Right. And but what's descant then? I can't remember what that is.
Well, that could be
another form
of that. But I'm not a great.
So, but it has a religious sort of connotation then. This chanting of the. The top 100. Presumably, you don't get through the whole top 100 in 10 minutes, do you?
Yes,
you do.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So this was about 30.
About 30 some. People are named. Yeah, it was Ai Weiwei, Gerhard Richter, mm-hmm. Glenn Brown. Was it?
Glenn Lowry.
Glenn Lowry. Yeah. Okay.
He's the director of the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Right.
And Ivan Wirth, people like that.
Okay.
Hauser and Wirth.
So
the list, it has a number of artists, but mostly it's people in the with different roles in the industry: curators, directors, and gallerists.
Right, but are you sort of saying that by giving them this religious sort of feeling, what is the is this like a hallowed? Is this like a hall of the great or something? You're kind of. Is it reverent or are you wishing you were part of it?
Well, I think there's a sense that artists would like to be part of it, but also are repulsed by it at the same time.
Right.
So there's
right.
For me that's okay. That's a kind of something, because I would like to make a living with my practice and things like that.
Right.
So in order to make a living in practice under the current regime of kind of hyper capitalism, there you have to be kind of in the star system in order to make a proper, even to pay your mortgage.
So is it a sort of, do you think that the art world is like a sort of pyramid structure then? You've got like, presumably there's like five at the top and then you've got this 100 and then you've got say a million practicing artists all around the world.
I think it's complicated in certain ways, but it's simple in other ways. We're basically there's a class, a kind of a system of
a hierarchy
of hierarchies, and that's
Can that ever be? Presumably, that can never be changed, really. There's always going to be. However, what is it? Joseph Beuys talked about everyone being an artist, but presumably there's always going to be Gerhard Richter or Francis Bacon or whatever who turn out to be the ones who are just better than anybody else.
Well, I think there is certainly there's room for talent and to consider that certain things like that. But also, I think there's structural problems that indicate structural inequity as well. I would say there's many artists that are talented that don't have recognition because of the structure of the system.
Yeah.
And there's others that have don't have very much talent and aren't very interesting, but have a lot of that are making lots of dosh in the system. So there there's interesting trade-offs. I think those are that's sort of part of our life, but I think there have been a few moments historically where there has been under certain non-capitalist regimes, which haven't lasted very long, there has been different kind of structures of systems of who achieves at a higher level.
Right.
For instance, in Soviet bloc countries, people who could never have been physicists or medical doctors or things like that, under capitalist regime where education is more expensive and things like that, are rise in rose in power. So you had in the Soviet Union, you had artists who might never have made it in a kind of capitalist system. So I'm not sort of defending one regime over another necessarily, but there certainly are historical regimes where things were different.
Okay. What do you want to do next? Do you want to read a piece from the book, or do you want to talk about the children's choir, or
I'll do. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the children's choir.
Okay.
And maybe briefly.
This is actually a case in point, isn't it? This is where you've assembled a choir of children. Is that right? Did you pick them, or how did this come about?
They came. We kind of picked them. It was a kind of a trade of. We went into a few schools and talked to the students about
in Canada.
In Canada.
Yeah.
I've done two versions of the choir, well, three actually, and one in Australia. Ah. I guess the biggest one was in Australia, where we had...
I'm just going to interrupt you for a minute. In the background, we've got the sound of a helicopter overhead. We can even hear it in this so-called, supposedly soundproof studio, and many sirens. It's now 3:10 on a Friday afternoon, and I did hear somebody mention as we came into the studio there was something about apparently hundreds of police up at London Bridge Station. So I don't quite know what's going on there, but we can hear the distant throb of an overhead helicopter. But anyway, do go on. Sorry.
Well, thanks for that information.
Yeah, sort of news bulletin.
I was wondering what that sound was.
Yes, completely unfounded news bulletin. Okay.
And so, I have the. I'm the artistic director of this choral enterprise, which is a kind of project where we invite the children to become the writers of the libretto, as well as the writers of the music. So. We elicit tunes and we elicit text and sounds styles from them, and so with the dogs and boats and airplanes we worked with a lot of stories about dogs and boats and airplanes that the children had, and then from there we made a non-linguistic choral piece,
right?
Which maybe we can play.
We could play some. Yeah. Should we play some of that now?
Yeah, thank you.
And then we'll try and maybe we can catch up with what's going on outside. So Graham 2. It's a slow build up.
Quietly, okay? So this is going to be a long session, so just keep on moving when
with it. So we're ready to go. Remember, we're going to have the 10 seconds of silence at the end as well. So, okay, one. Hands down. Two. And three.
Yeah.
So this is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is Bill Burns, a Canadian artist, director of the Safety Gear for Small Animals. And we're listening to your record, Bill, Dogs and Boats and Aeroplanes, which is it a self-published limited edition vinyl LP?
Yeah, it's published by a small organization, of which I'm the director as well.
Okay.
so I guess you could say self-published.
So these are the children, it's a choir of children who are kind of emulating the sounds of, in turn, it sounds like, a succession of dogs and then boats and then aeroplanes.
That's right. And in order to get to work with them and collaborate with them, we talked about their relationships with dogs and boats and airplanes. And I also talked to them about the story of Ivan the Terrible, and we watched some excerpts from Ivan the Terrible, the film by Sergei Eisenstein. And we also considered the sounds that they're making, which are, you know, airplane propellers, lapping water against boats or creaking pirate ships.
Right.
And dogs barking, of course.
Do planes figure in Ivan the Terrible?
No, they don't.
I was going to say, possibly boats and dogs.
Yes, but okay. But we just used them as tools to kind of work on a, you know, on a kind of vocabulary that where you could have sounds that were, you know, sort of outside of linguistic territories.
Right.
And so the children work with pictures and words and stuff, and we came up with a script, a libretto eventually, and then and also we elicited kind of musicality from them as well.
Okay.
So
how did, why Ivan the Terrible by Eisenstein? Why would that film, of all films, why would that one be the choice?
Well, for me, it was part of my conceit with the project, which was to try and find a very iconic work. And it was, I wanted to work with the schools in terms of, you know, what kind of iconic work we could find that had a reference to kind of world literature or world cinematography.
Right,
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yes, okay. And should we mention that you teach, you have been teaching regularly in the Yukon, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And you have a sort of residency up there?
Yeah. Maybe we'll take the sound down and then I can explain a little bit about my work up there, which I work in a small school called the Yukon School of Visual Arts. And it's a foundation level school, and it's run by the Trandegwichen First Nation in northern Canada, and we run a more or less classical foundation avant-garde kind of structure of an art school, but we also have a lot of relations with the First Nation, and they teach us a lot about traditional methods as well, like weaving, fishing, and how to live on the land,
right,
as well. So it's kind of a magical place, it's a strange and magical at the same time.
Right. Do you think that would this be an appropriate moment to play a short track by this Inuit CD or not? Or do we not have time for that?
Maybe we can give it a...
Should we give it a bit?
Yeah,
can just sort of give it a burst of this. Yeah. This is a... this is track 52. This is a recording of Inuit 55 historical recordings. And this section is from North Greenland and Canada.
Okay.
Is that anywhere near your neck of the woods?
It's kind of far from our neck of the woods, but there is a traditional singing in that area. And most of it comes... Most of the people I work with are from the Trandegwichen First Nation, and the Inuit are the neighboring people. And so we have relations.
All right, we'll give this a snatch of this. They're all very, very short tracks, as it happens, so we can...
Yeah.
So that dates from 1962, that particular track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for playing that. And it reminds me of a couple of things I wanted to mention. In the North, when I arrived for my teaching, and this was a surprise at first, and then I've learned quite a bit from people, and I still have a lot to learn. But I've been often given small gifts from people passing through or from people when I arrive, and they are traditionally I'm given a gift of caribou meat, usually like quite a large piece, maybe a few kilograms. And then also another gesture that I get from people who travel from further north are a piece of whale blubber is also a traditional kind of gift. And both of those are very kind of, they're profoundly connected to the culture and the land. And it's what kind of inspired my project that I was trying to explain to Paul Robertson at Less Than the Apple.
The milk and the goat's milk.
Well, the goat's milk and also the kind of transactional trading kind of circle that we were thinking of, that I'm trying to make happen, which would be making things from, taking something from China to Canada, then taking something from Canada to Argentina, and then from Argentina to Greece.
So when you arrive, when you go to the Yukon, or to some part of the Yukon, would people greet you with this, with either caribou meat or whale blubber or whatever it is?
Yeah,
and are you expected to reciprocate in some way? Are you supposed to give something back, or is it
That's what was interesting to me, there wasn't anything really expected in return. So there was this kind of, so what it brought to me was kind of a sense of something new in the mind, because my world is full of transactions. Just like going on the underground is a transaction in many ways, or going into a shop or whatever. Our world is full of these kind of transactions, but this was a transaction that was very different. I could sense this because it was a gift that had nothing expected, no expectation in return. They were basically strangers to me who were showing respect by giving me a sacred piece of meat, for instance.
Okay.
So those were really, it was profound and moving to have those, to have that experience.
Okay.
So that's sort of what started my project, what I'm trying to do. My project last summer in Switzerland, for instance, I acquired some salt from the local mine. I hired two donkeys, and I took the salt up the mountain on the backs of the donkeys. And on the way up, we traded some salt for some apples at the orchard on the way up. And then I took some apples and traded them for honey at the second stop. And at the summit of the mountain was the barn, which is a typical kind of situation in Switzerland, because they have pasture lands at different levels. And then we had, I sliced the apples and dipped them in honey and put a pinch of salt on them and served them to the audience, the spectators. And it happened to be Rosh Hashanah, which is a Jewish New Year. And at Rosh Hashanah, the tradition is to eat fruit with honey.
Okay.
So it kind of...
Was that a complete coincidence?
It was. It was a coincidence, but I put it
It's almost mystical.
Yes. So. Yeah. So maybe.
So that becomes like a sort of ritual. It's a sort of almost a performance piece stroke ritual. You do this in various places depending on where you are. Yeah. The ritual might change depending on which part of the world you're in.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to Argentina this year, and I'll be doing some sheep shearing and procuring some wool from some sheep.
Right.
But should we maybe end up with a song by Todd Lippy?
I think we're getting to that time. We can play out with another track by Todd Lippy, your colleague in America. What's this track called?
It's called Good Start.
Good Start. Okay. Well, thank you very much to Bill Burns for coming in today. And we'll play out with this track by Todd Lippy, and another American artist. He's an American artist.
Yeah? Yes.
But happens to make music as well.
And the record's called Here We Are.
A good start means you're half done. That's what my dad says. Is what his dad said.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.